All right. Well, you might remember the names if you were around in the late 90s. Eric Harris and Dylan Klebold. Those were the two guys who carried out the shooting that took place at Columbine High School in 1999. And 13 people were killed, 24 others were wounded. Of course, there have been a number of mass shootings since then. One of the questions I want us to think about this morning is, this might seem like a weird question, but it's not. I think it's a good question for us to think about. And the question is, what happens in a person's heart that leads them to that place, right? I mean, was it something in their upbringing? Did something happen to them as a child? Was there mental illness involved? What road does a person have to travel down in order to get to that point? And with these two teenagers, Harris and Klebold, it seems there was a lot of envy and bitterness and anger. And if you really want to understand Harris and Klebold, which, you know, fair warning, if you were going to do this, it would require you to stomach a lot of profanity. But you can actually go online and you can read their journals. You can read what they wrote. And what you find is there's a lot of envy and resentment. So in one of Eric Harris's journals, he and authorities sort of see Harris as the mastermind of the behind the shooting. But one of his journals presents a list of things that he loves and a list of things that he hates. And so of the things that he hates, he hates when people walk slowly in front of him. He hates when he goes to the mall and there are groups of people that are congregated in certain places so that he can't get through. He hates people who bump into him because they don't watch where they're going. He hates school. He hates people who thought they were martial arts experts. He hates liars. He hates racists. He hates how the O.J. Simpson, or how the media was focused on the O.J. Simpson trial, which was something that was happening at the time. But then he also presents some things that he loves. So, okay, well, what's a guy like this love? Well, he loves it when some stuck-up rich guy crashes his car. He loves it when some child, some kid blows his hand off with a firework because he's not smart enough to understand about fireworks. He loves making fun of stupid people. So those are things on the list of things that he loves. And you can read all of his journals. You can read the other things that he wrote. But one of the things that becomes clear is he hated the world, right? In fact, the first line in his written journal is, "I hate the explicative world." And he was bitter and resentful, and he just wanted to destroy everything. And in fact, the plan that they originally had, it wasn't just a school shooting. The original plan that they had was they intended to do more with some explosive devices they had constructed, and they hoped to kill a lot more people, which fortunately they were unsuccessful in that. But Dr. Robert Hare is a psychologist who has analyzed the case, and Hare wrote this about Eric Harris. Quote, speaking of Eric Harris, "He's disgusted with the morons around him. These are not the rantings of an angry young man picked on by jocks until he's not going to take it anymore. These are the rantings of someone with a messianic-grade superiority complex out to punish the entire human race for its appalling inferiority." End quote. And when a person looks at the world and grows resentful in the way that Eric Harris did, this is where it can lead, right? And in fact, this is where it led for the first person who was ever born on the face of the planet. So let's open our Bibles to Genesis chapter 4. Genesis chapter 4, we'll be looking at verses 1 through 16. Genesis 4, verses 1 through 16. And the question I want us to wrestle with this morning is, What is it that leads a person to take the life of another human being? And it's not that, you know, I'm thinking, okay, you know, this is probably going to be an issue for many of us or anything like that. I'm not especially concerned that any of us would ever arrive at that destination, though I suppose it's possible. But, you know, by God's grace, I pray and expect none of us will. And yet, all of us at certain points in our lives, although we might not get anywhere close to that destination, sometimes we travel on that road of bitterness and resentment. In fact, Jesus talks about the fact that we're all murderers at heart, right? Because whoever harbors hatred for his neighbor is counted as a murderer, because it's the same heart condition that leads people to go out and commit murder. So what is it that happens in a person's heart and mind that leads them to that place? And perhaps more importantly, how do we escape that pattern of bitterness and resentment? Look with me at Genesis chapter 4, beginning in verse 1. Now Adam knew Eve, his wife, and she conceived and bore Cain, saying, I have gotten a man with the help of the Lord. And again she bore his brother Abel. Now Abel was a keeper of sheep, and Cain a worker of the ground. In the course of time, Cain brought to the Lord an offering of the fruit of the ground, and Abel also brought of the firstborn of his flock and of their fat portions. And the Lord had regard for Abel and his offering, but for Cain and his offering he had no regard. So Cain was very angry, and his face fell. The Lord said to Cain, Why are you angry? And why has your face fallen? If you do well, will you not be accepted? And if you do not do well, sin is crouching at the door. Its desire is for you, but you must rule over it. Cain spoke to Abel, his brother. And when they were in the field, Cain rose up against his brother Abel and killed him. Then the Lord said to Cain, Where is Abel, your brother? He said, I do not know. Am I my brother's keeper? And the Lord said, What have you done? The voice of your brother's blood is crying out to me from the ground. And now you are cursed from the ground, which has opened its mouth to receive your brother's blood from your hand. When you work the ground, it shall no longer yield to you its strength. You shall be a fugitive and a wanderer on the earth. Cain said to the Lord, My punishment is greater than I can bear. Behold, you have driven me today away from the ground, and from your face I shall be hidden. I shall be a fugitive and a wanderer on the earth, and whoever finds me will kill me. Then the Lord said to him, Not so. If anyone kills Cain, vengeance shall be taken on him sevenfold. And the Lord put a mark on Cain, lest any who found him should attack him. Then Cain went away from the presence of the Lord and settled in the land of Nod, east of Eden. All right, so we have the story of Cain and Abel. And at the outset of the story, of course, both Cain and Abel bring a sacrifice to God. And, you know, part of the idea behind a sacrifice is I'm giving up something of value now, perhaps, in order to gain something of greater value later. And it's sort of like the marshmallow test. If you've ever seen the marshmallow test, where you take some, you know, 4 or 5 year old kids, right? And so you get a 4 or 5 year old kid, you put him in a room, and you give him a plate with one of those jumbo marshmallows on the plate, and you say, "Okay, this marshmallow is yours, and you can eat it. You can eat it now, or you can wait until I come back, and at that point I'll give you another marshmallow and you can have 2 marshmallows, right?" And then the person goes away and they videotape these kids smelling the marshmallow and licking the marshmallow and trying to resist the temptation to eat the marshmallow. And so it's a sacrifice, right? You sacrifice having the marshmallow now in order to have 2 marshmallows later. And if you've ever dieted, you can probably relate to the temptation to just eat the marshmallow now. But the idea is if you sacrifice something now, you can ultimately gain something of greater value. And this is something that animals don't understand, right? There was an article in Newsweek 2 months ago where all of these cows escaped and they found their winter food supply. And they ate all of this food, and 22 cows actually ate themselves to death. And, you know, it's not like the cows think, wow, this is a lot of food. Maybe we should save some of this for later, right? Wolves are sort of the same way. And with wolves, it's either feast or famine. And when a pack of wolves brings down a moose, they can eat a lot of meat. Of course, if they were smart, maybe they'd ration it out over a few days. But wolves don't have the capacity to barter with the future in the way that human beings do. And during the time of Cain and Abel, when a person offered a sacrifice, it exhibited a level of trust and faithfulness on the part of the one making the sacrifice. Now, why did God have regard for Abel's offering and not for Cain's offering? And that's an important question that people often wrestle with. I say it's an important question. That might be overstated. It's certainly a question that people wrestle with. And I think the reason is we want our sacrifices to be pleasing to God, right? And, you know, we make sacrifices such as when we give of, you know, our financial resources to the advancement of the gospel or something like that. And so when we think about the sacrifices that we might make with our time and our talent and our treasure, maybe we think, well, we want our sacrifice to be pleasing to God. We want to do whatever it was that Abel did that God was pleased, and we don't want to do what Cain did that God wasn't pleased. The problem with that is we don't know what it was about the offerings that God found Abel's offering pleasing and that he didn't have regard for Cain's offering. And, you know, I think this question, other questions like this, can sometimes cause us to miss the point of the text. I knew a guy once who, he spent time studying the Bible. And at one point he told me, you know, he would come to places in the Bible where he maybe didn't understand a biblical text. And so he would go and he would find a commentary on the Bible, or maybe a couple of commentaries. And his comment to me was, you know, when I go to these commentaries and I read them, they don't answer my questions, right? And maybe he was looking at bad commentaries. That's a possibility. But what I think was probably more likely, and my response to him was, maybe he was asking questions that the biblical text wasn't trying to answer. Right? Because if you have a good commentary on Genesis and you come to the commentary saying, why did God accept Abel's sacrifice and not Cain's sacrifice? A good commentator probably isn't going to comment on that because that's actually not something that is raised in the text. One of my professors in grad school, John Walton, said it this way. So he's talking about the fact that this story doesn't tell us certain things, and such as why God didn't accept Cain's offering. And he says, the fact that the story doesn't tell us certain things is not an invitation for us to speculate about the gaps or lament the omission of details. We need to practice the discipline of reading the lines instead of reading between the lines. A successful interpretation is not one that fills in the gaps most persuasively. It's the one that lets the gaps remain gaps and articulates the cohesiveness of the text as it stands. And that's exactly the point. That's part of what we are trying to do in seeking uncompromising biblical faithfulness, right? We want to read the Bible in the way that the original authors intended it to be read. And so, again, we don't know why God has regard for Abel's offering and not for Cain's. But what we do know is that God has regard for the one and not for the other, with the result that Cain becomes envious of Abel. It's interesting. So often sin comes with seemingly righteous motives, right? So Cain's desire is that God would accept his sacrifice, which is a good desire, right? That's a good thing to want and to pursue. And there are so many times like that when sin in our lives comes under that sort of a guise. There are certain times when Stacy and I, maybe we have a disagreement about something, and sometimes I will speak harshly or unlovingly or unkindly or judgmentally or whatever. And almost always in the moment when that happens, I think I'm in the right. You know, I'm not thinking, okay, I know it's a sin for me to talk this way, but I'm just really upset and I'm going to say it anyway. I mean, that could happen. But more generally, I see, you know, there's this truth that she needs to understand. And if I do this, then that'll help her to understand it, or something along those lines. And here, Cain is upset that his sacrifice isn't accepted. But rather than trying to listen to God and rather than trying to do the right thing, he becomes envious of Abel. Now, envy is an interesting thing. So I was thinking about envy. And so here's the definition of envy. Envy is the feeling of inadequacy that we sometimes feel when we compare ourselves to other people. So it's not necessarily a foregone conclusion that if I have a desire for something that someone else has, that I will automatically become envious. Because I might see someone who has a certain degree of competence in a certain area. So let's say I'm a fisherman, and you know, I enjoy fishing. I try to be a good fisherman, and I see somebody else who is a more competent fisherman than I am. Right, so one way I can respond is I can have respect for that person. And, you know, if I have a certain kind of respect for him, maybe I want to be as good a fisherman as he is. And so I watch him, right? I respect him. I watch him carefully to see what he does so that, you know, maybe I can change some of the things I'm doing and become a better fisherman. Maybe I go to him and ask him for advice, or I ask him for counsel, I ask him to mentor me, or something along those lines, right? That's a humble response, right? It acknowledges, you know, he's better than me, and I have something that I could potentially learn from him, and, you know, there's this attitude of respect. Or I can respond, rather than responding in humility, I can respond with a certain kind of pride. And I can say, you know, something like, well, this guy, you know, he thinks he's this master fisherman, but he spends all of his money on this crazy fishing equipment that doesn't take any talent to use. And anybody who has the kind of fishing equipment that he has can go out and they can catch anything, right? And so, you know, my sense of superiority as a fisherman is threatened, and now I go on the attack against him. That's envy. Right, and that's grounded in pride. So if I have respect for the person, I look to him as a model to follow, that's something that comes from humility. But when I respond in envy, in bitterness, that's just grounded in the fact that I want to be seen as superior. And so it's pride. And one of the things about pride is that when pride is wounded, it wants to strike back, right? Like, one way I can respond is I can go around and I can talk about how he's not really a good fisherman, how he just has this good fishing equipment. Another way I can respond is I can go out at night when he's fishing alone and I can just kill him, right? Which is what Cain did. And it begins with pride. When pride becomes wounded, that's what happened to Cain when God points out his shortcomings. And too often, it's the way that people respond sometimes when they read the Bible, right? Because, you know, if I live a sexually immoral lifestyle, let's say, and I come to the Bible and it says that it condemns that kind of behavior, then I can respond with humility and I can say, okay, well, you know, maybe God understands something that I don't understand. Or I can respond proudly, and I can go on the attack. And I think a lot of attacks against the Bible come from that kind of thing, because someone's pride was wounded. So your inadequacies have been exposed, your pride's wounded, now you want to strike back. Who do you strike? Cain obviously took it out on Abel. Adam blamed Eve. Eve blamed the serpent. Whenever interpersonal conflict arises, whether it's with a family member or a spouse or a friend, you can spend all of your time and energy and resources focusing on how the other person is at fault, or focusing on the extent to which the other person is at fault, and you can blame your spouse or your coworkers or your boss or your upbringing or whatever. And, you know, don't get me wrong, because it's not like people aren't ever victimized. It's not like, you know, sometimes someone has a spouse who is at serious fault, or someone has parents who are seriously at fault, or something like that. Because it might be the case that when you blame someone else, they really are at fault. But the point is that regardless of the degree of responsibility they might bear, if you want to blame someone else for your problems, it's pretty easy to find someone who bears some degree of responsibility. So you can blame someone. If you can't find someone else to blame, one thing you can do is you can blame society as a whole. Right? And so the reason I can't get ahead in the world is because I'm living in a rigged system, right? And the powerful people are at the top and they're controlling everything. And the nice thing about that is you don't just become embittered towards one person, you become embittered towards the entire world. And I think that's how you end up with someone like Eric Harris, right? That's how you end up with a mass shooter at times. Because if you end up with Cain killing Abel when Cain's envy and bitterness grows to a sufficient point, then if someone sufficiently fuels his bitterness and resentment against society as a whole, you know, where's that going to end up? What happens if he follows that trajectory? So we can blame someone else, we can blame society as a whole, or we can skip all the formalities and we can just blame God. Right, because whenever we are bitter and resentful about some difficulty in our lives, we're really inadvertently blaming God. God is sovereign. He's in control of everything that happens. God works all things after the counsel of his will, Ephesians 1:11. And as Christians, God has promised us in Christ that he will work all things for our good. So, you know, that doesn't mean that we don't experience difficulty. It doesn't mean that the difficulties and the calamities that come into our lives are good things, or that we view them as good things. It doesn't mean that you necessarily respond in joy when you find out that you have cancer or something like that. It just means that God will use the difficulties and the tragedies for our ultimate good. And it means that in the midst of our grief over the truly bad things that we experience, which are truly bad things, we have this unwavering hope in God's promise. And so we are grieved and we are troubled, but we are not grieved and troubled as those who have no hope. Some people experience bitterness and resentment towards God when trials come. Other people turn to God and rely on him when they experience the very same trials, right? And so it's that thing of how the same sun that melts the ice hardens the clay. And when we're brought into God's family and we come to understand that he is good and that he has our best interests at heart, the knowledge that my trial ultimately comes from God's hand is actually a comforting thing. Or we can think about it this way. So if your response depends upon the outcome of the situation, the way that you will respond will obviously depend on how things turn out, right? If I'm diagnosed with cancer, then, you know, either I can overcome that and go into remission, or maybe it's terminal and at some point they tell me that I'm not going to make it. And so if my response depends on that outcome, I may respond towards God with thanksgiving if I'm okay, and then I may shake my fist at God if I'm not ultimately going to be okay. And so rather than blaming other people, rather than blaming society as a whole, rather than blaming God, a better response is to focus on our own responsibility, right? I mean, this is obviously what Cain should have done. God comes to Cain, he says, if you do right, will you not be accepted? Maybe Cain didn't know exactly what he was supposed to do, but had he heeded God's word, he could have at least started to try to figure out what he should do. Because there are basically two ways that a person can live. And one way is to look at your problems and blame others and to grow bitter and resentful towards the world. The other way is to look at your problems and trust the Lord and try to figure out what the Lord would have you to do about them. So, you know, it's basically two different lines of reasoning. One line of reasoning says, okay, God is in control and he has ultimately allowed this thing into my life. He's brought this thing into my life. The second premise is to say, okay, well, God is good, and therefore I can trust him. The other thing is to recognize, okay, God has brought this into my life, but then rather than looking at God's character, you look at the situation, and you say it's a bad situation, and then you make a conclusion about God's character. He must be a bad God for allowing this thing to come into my life. It's two different ways of reasoning. And so if you have a relationship where there's conflict, you can blame the other person for the conflict, you can stoke the fires of bitterness, or you can ask yourself, well, you know, what could I do differently? How would God have me to handle this situation? Again, it isn't to say that when you encounter difficulty in your relationships that it's necessarily your fault, because if you're being bullied on the playground, you know, that's not your fault. And you can't change the heart of a bully. Actually, you can do certain things that might change the heart of a bully. You can, a soft answer turns away wrath, right? So you can do that. It might work, it might not work. Ultimately, you can't change the heart of a bully, but you can try to be faithful. You can try to exercise wisdom, and you can do what you believe God would have you do given the reality of the bully. And if you experience conflict in your marriage and spend all of your time stoking the fires of bitterness toward your spouse rather than thinking about what you could be do differently, then that's obviously not going to lead anywhere good. And it's interesting because, you know, as a pastor, I've had opportunities to counsel couples who are experiencing conflict. And I'm going to say about 9 times out of 10, when a couple comes in and you set them down and you say, okay, well, what's the problem? One spouse starts off and they start listing all of the bad things that the other spouse is doing, right? And the problem is he's doing this, he's doing this, he's not doing this. And, you know, you hear her out. And then when she gets done, you say, okay, well, from your perspective, what's the problem? And he's like, well, yeah, maybe I'm a little lax here and a little lax here. But she, and then he has this long list of things that she's doing, right? And she's the problem. The thing to do is to look at the situation and ask yourself, well, what can I do different, right? And if each spouse were to do that, I mean, that's, you know, 90% of solving the problem. Alexander Solzhenitsyn, he was a prisoner in a Russian gulag under Joseph Stalin's regime. And he wrote a book about his experience there and the experience of fellow prisoners. And so he talks about how, you know, he's arrested without cause, like no reason, but he's arrested. Tells all of these stories of different people who were arrested for no reason. I remember one story that he told. There was they needed to have people to work, right? Because communism sort of is a demotivator, right? If you just kind of provide for everyone, then they just take it, and you know, you don't have to work as hard. So the way you get people to work is you put them in a work camp and you force them to work. And so the secret police, they had quotas, apparently, that they needed to get. And there was a woman who, she was reporting on her neighbor. She was suspicious of her neighbor. And so she came in and she sat in the waiting room. And they needed to get a few more people. It was, you know, before the weekend or whatever. And so they just arrested her because she was there. It was convenient for them. And there were lots of things like that. So arrested without cause, he was tortured in numerous ways, imprisoned, starved, and he recounts all of this in very graphic detail. Well, as he's sitting there in prison, he begins to ask himself this question. He says, what could I have done differently so that I wouldn't have ended up here? Which is quite a question to ask yourself. And ultimately, he comes to the conclusion that he, along with the rest of society, had been willing to turn a blind eye to all of what the abuses of the state. And so he concluded that had he stand firm, had he stood up, had he spoken against the state, had he encouraged other people to do that, it could have resulted in the fall of the Soviet Union. But Cain doesn't look at what he might have done differently. He becomes bitter, he becomes resentful, and so he kills his brother. And this is where pride ultimately leads if it's not headed off. Because, you know, when you think you deserve something that someone else has, or you're humiliated because you are in some way shown to be inferior to someone else, pride is at the root of that. And so that leads to envy and bitterness and resentment, which in turn leads us to try to destroy God's good creation. Right? That's what Cain was doing when he killed Abel. And again, I don't necessarily think that any of us will get to that place, although apart from God's grace, that's what we all would do. But we do have other more subtle ways of trying to destroy the world and other people. You know, so you go into work on Monday morning, you don't smile at anyone, you lament the fact that it's Monday, you do your work as begrudgingly as possible. If any of your coworkers are remotely chipper or happy, then you run them down to your other coworkers behind their backs, you talk about how naive they are, you talk about how silly they are, you take every opportunity to complain about how stupid people are and make fun of people who do stupid things. On your way home, you get behind someone who's slow, you begin to get impatient with them, you come home to your family, you complain about your day, and pretty soon your attitude and your heart condition reads like the journal of the Columbine shooter. And you're doing everything that you can to try to make your own little corner of the world as much a hell on earth as you can manage. And I don't think it's insignificant that the first human being ever born was a murderer, right? In John chapter 8, Jesus says that Satan was a murderer from the beginning. Well, you know, so was humankind. And apart from God's grace, the resentment and the bitterness that we sometimes harbor towards our neighbor would lead to the same place. And yet in Christ, God doesn't abandon us to that. Right? We can note that God justly punishes Cain. And he basically sentences Cain to be a wanderer on the face of the earth. And yet in justice, God remembers mercy. And God, in some way, he puts this mark on Cain so that whoever finds him wandering alone doesn't do to him what he did to his brother, which is actually what he deserved. But God doesn't give him what he deserves, because although God is just, he's also merciful. And in the same way that God doesn't give Cain what he deserves, God doesn't give us what we deserve, right? Because in our heart of hearts, we are all like Cain, right? We're all murderers at heart. We've all harbored the same kind of bitterness and the same kind of resentment, maybe not to the same extent, but it's the same thing in our own hearts and lives. And yet God sent his son into the world to take the punishment that we deserved upon himself so that we could be forgiven, so that we could be restored to a relationship with God, and so that we could be set free from the misery of a life of bitterness and resentment. Because there's nothing more miserable than the bitterness and resentment of someone who lives to hate the world. And yet God so loved the world that he gave his only son so that we could be set free free from the bitterness and resentment, and so that we could look at the world and rejoice as we see God's glory displayed.